Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Tammy Vinson. Growing up in a home filled with addiction and chaos, Tammy Vinson experienced firsthand the profound impact it could have on a child's life. The wounds ran deep, affecting her self-esteem, relationships, and overall well-being. However, Tammy refused to let the past define her. She embarked on a courageous journey of self-work, determined to break free from the chains of her upbringing. Through years of personal growth, introspection, and professional training, she transformed her own life. Armed with a master's in education, NLP certification, and expertise in addiction counseling, she's honed her skills to become a compassionate and effective coach. Tammy's mission is to empower individuals who are navigating similar challenges, providing them with the tools and guidance to reclaim their lives. Tammy, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thank you so much, Dave. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes. And we met through, I think it was a Facebook group called Podcast Guests, and I had posted about my podcast in that group, and you had reached out to me, and your story resonated with me on a lot of different levels, but primarily for myself, being a former addictions counselor and a clinical supervisor, I worked with many individuals who came from homes where they had alcoholic or drug addicted parents. Anyway, please tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path.
Well, it started honestly in utero because my mom was already doing cocaine, drinking, partying, yelling, screaming, being stressed out when she was pregnant with me. So I literally was born on edge. If you can imagine that, right? You don't even have a chance to come into the world in peace. But I went through years and years and years of just not feeling good about myself. My parents were always fighting. I just kind of shied away from everything. I just wanted to feel small my whole life. So there was a lot of physical abuse. There was a lot of mental abuse. My mom specifically, my father was a very kind and gentle man, but he was also an alcoholic. So he was battling kind of his own demons. But my mom told me from the time I was 3 or 4 years old that she wished I was never born. I would have been better off dead and I was never going to amount to anything. And I took those things to heart. And even though I knew at a young age, like I remember saying to my dad when I was 5, why does mommy hate me? She says she hates me. And he was like, your mom doesn't hate you. She just drinks a lot. And when she drinks, she doesn't know what she's saying. So she doesn't hate you. And then he said, but if you feel like she does, then I will be your mom and your dad. And I will step in and be both for you. You don't need to listen to her anymore. So it was like literally at 5 years old, I was like, what do you mean not listen to my mom? She's my mom. So it was just years and years of that. And at one point my dad had gotten remarried and it was a very toxic relationship. Mm-hmm. It didn't last long. But in that, they had sent me to go live with my mother. They were then divorced at the time. And my mother was really heavy into drugs. She was being really, really heavy. She wasn't working. I wasn't working. Or when I got a job, she was stealing my money. So I just went through a tough time. I did have a suicide attempt and thank goodness it failed because I'm here to talk about it today. But it was just, you know, I realized that in my early 20s that there were so many things that followed me into adulthood that I just didn't have a clue about. Relationships, boundaries, children, how to have children, how to raise them, just all kinds of stuff. I'm on a journey now. I want to share with people two things. One is that if they're growing up in that, that they do have a voice, that there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's never a child's fault. And teach them different ways of coping, you know, coping with compassion and empathy instead of hate and anger and stuff that's going to eat you up inside. And then I also want to share with adults that if you did go through it and you all these characteristics and coping mechanisms that you acquired as a child to save yourself, that they no longer serve you, but there's ways that you can undo them and unravel some of those layers and learn to be happy again.
And you made a really, really good point about the fact that what we learn in childhood follows us through adulthood. And what is modeled for us as children, unless that narrative is changed or unless that's interrupted, it's going to play out in relationships. It's going to play out in our ability or inability to set boundaries. It's going to play out in our ability to experience or feel intimacy with another individual and trust, not only with other individuals, but with ourselves as well, too. So, one of the things I wanted to ask you, did you ever like go to somebody else's house just to see what normal looked like?
Up until fourth grade, I really only had one friend, and unfortunately, our parents partied together.
Okay.
So I never really saw normal. I did a couple times, but to me, my normal was normal. I remember when going to my friend's house and we had a party and her sister got hit in the head with a baseball bat accidentally. It was just a mistake, but nobody could even take her to the hospital because here all the parents had been drinking. So I was like, well, isn't anyone going to help this kid? And I remember she had this big old welt on her head. And I'm like, okay, this can't be right. But no, I don't remember ever seeing what I call the Brady Bunch family, you know, just that normal sit down to dinner. My parents were both chain smokers. So like I sat down to dinner and there was two ashtrays going and beer bottles and scotch. And there was never this calm, just sit down to dinner, pass a plate.
Yeah, because I've had other clients that I've worked with in the past have told me that they went to somebody else's house just to see what normal looked like. Because if they figured that everybody could be living like I'm living. But then when they saw that atmosphere, Tammy, it was still foreign to them because there was a different set of rules and they could not totally assimilate into that household because the rules were different.
Yes. I probably would not have fared well. We didn't have rules. We didn't have boundaries. We really didn't have anything. I was kind of on my own. But I do remember about the eighth grade going to my friend's house and her parents came home from work while we were there. We were doing our homework or something. And I remember they sat there and they hugged each other and they were talking about the day. And it was so like almost surreal. Like I was watching it and I was like, wow, people do that? Like people hug and are affectionate and loving. And I'm like, I don't remember ever. I don't even have a memory of my mother hugging me, let alone hugging my father. Mm-hmm. And even when my dad got remarried, it was toxic. And it was what I consider lust and anger all wrapped up in a marriage. You know, there was not even then, it wasn't even normal.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing normative about growing up in a dysfunctional household. And it could be an addicted parent. It could be a household where there's been a history of physical or abuse or domestic violence, sexual abuse. It could be a variety of different things that also contribute to individuals' choice and path to the road of drug addiction. Now, was there a history of alcoholism, Tammy, in all of your generations of your family, or was it just your parents, or do you recall that history being more extensive?
No, it was extensive. My grandfather both of my grandparents on my mother's side were alcoholics. I didn't meet my grandfather on my father's side until I was in, I think, the eighth grade. But I know there was a lot of people in recovery, but there was a lot of addiction. My uncles, everybody that I knew of on my mother's side, pretty much. And a lot of mental health issues, too. Yeah. My mom, I mean, that was back in the 60s and 70s, and she was not even clinically, from what we knew, diagnosed, but she was a child psychiatrist. So I'm sure she knew what was going on. But at the very least today, I would call her at the very least bipolar, 100%. She could be talking to you one minute and you'd be having a conversation and she'd be laughing. And then the next minute she's pouring boiling water down my brother's back for no reason. Just the mood swings and the flips. And I remember coming home one day and I was like, I remember looking at my brother walking in the house and going, I wonder which mom we're getting today. It was just like, who knows?
And that, given her challenges, that's a legitimate question to ask, but also living in a household where one or both parents have addiction, that's a legitimate question, I think, to ask every day. Which parent am I getting today? Is it going to be the sober parent? Is it going to be the drug addicted parent? Who am I getting? And that has to really cause a lot of uncertainty moving forward for children who decide that when they leave the household, they got to take that uncertainty with them in terms of the relationships that they develop or are thinking about developing.
Right. And there's no normal, there's no peace. So even when I went to college, every noise startled me because I just never knew what was going to happen. You know, I would listen, and even 20 years later, I would listen when somebody opens a door to see how easily the key slides in. Because if the key kind of takes a minute to get in the door, there's a good chance the other person on the other side of that door has been drinking or doing drugs. And you automatically, like, your whole body just stays in fight or flight. And I think that's one of the things that I really, you know, I think that's one of the things I really want to stress to people. And that's why I went into coaching, was you can get rid of that stuff. And it took me 30 years, well, not 30 years. I've been gradually getting better and better and better. And I don't say I was broken, but there was a lot of stuff that needed to be, a lot of layers that needed to be pulled back. And just the sense of worthiness and the sense of, I can remember with my first husband, and people would say, you know, Tammy, that's not normal. That's not how people talk to someone they love. And I'm like, oh, really? Normal to me. You know, I'm used to feeling this big. I thought that was right. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of unlayering.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What did you do personally? How did you grow out of your circumstances? How did you grow into, you know, transcending what had happened to you? And how did the whole piece with introspection come into play in terms of your personal growth as well?
Well, there wasn't the internet back then. But I remember being 26 years old, and I tell this story a lot, but I remember it like it was yesterday. I was pregnant with my first child, and I'm rocking back and forth reading that book, Love You Forever. It's a children's book about an unconditional love between a mom and her son. And I had what I consider a total and complete mental breakdown, because I had never experienced unconditional love. So I did the only logical thing I could think of. I went out and got a puppy because I was like, I need to know if I'm even capable of loving something before I bring a human into the world. But I realized when I got that puppy, and I like remember holding that puppy in my hand, I was like, wow, this is what love feels like. And I'm like, what else don't I know? Like, what else don't I know? So I used to go down to the library and sit on the floor in the corner and just read psychology books, because there wasn't really self-help books back then, or personal development, or whatever you want to call it. It didn't exist. There were a few things, but I could just, any topic, I would just open books on alcoholism. I would, you know, what happens to your body when you're drinking? Why do you do this? You know, child abuse, sexual abuse, incest, rape. I mean, anything I could get my hands on that I thought what I would get answers to. And then I realized, obviously, the damage was deep. So I went to therapy. And that was my first step. I thought, I can do this. I can go to therapy. I was 26. And so I went to my first therapist. And I remember them saying to me that very end of the first session, something that now I know should have made me very angry. She goes, well, how did that make you feel? And I said, feel? I don't feel. Like, what do you mean feel? She's like, not happy, not sad. I'm like, oh, no. We don't do that feel thing. That's not fun. So I literally spent a year just doing nothing more than sitting, and I would get an emotion and I would be like, okay, what is that? That's anger. Like, I'm mad. And I would, whatever I had to do. So I did a lot. I just self-reflected. I didn't like talk therapy traditional talk therapy, and there's nothing wrong with it. I think it's a great thing to combine with other things. Like for me, it was yoga, and it was just moving my body and being out in nature and praying, whatever I had to do. And then the therapist would kind of guide me in the right direction. And then I would go home. But I always knew that it was more what was inside of me. And I don't know how. I remember thinking, if I survive this, there's got to be a reason. Don't know the reason, but there's got to be. So if there has to be a reason, that means that there must be some good in me. And that's when I started, now it's big. Now it's compassion and self-love and self-care. And that's really what I did. I did a lot of journaling. I used to write letters to myself. I used to write letters to the voice in my head that would yell at me. I would literally write letters to him. And now, of course, 20 years later, that's a normal thing to do. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what I tell my clients to do. But back then, I was just trying to voice something, anything, to anybody that would listen. And it was my journal.
Yeah. And journaling to me is can be our best friend, particularly when we don't have physical or human support available, or particularly that when we don't trust that the support we're going to get it is going to help us or validate our situation. So journaling, I think, is great because it can also be unfiltered. Your feelings can be placed there in raw form. There's nobody there judging it. You don't need to feel as you think your addictive parent wants you to feel or needs you to feel. I think journaling is a great tool. And also, what else with what you identified as well, too, with being out in nature and yoga and prayer, these are all holistic and spiritual practices that I think can help us feel connected to something greater than ourselves, which is so needed for individuals who come from chaotic households.
Absolutely. I mean, I went to Al-Anon too. I did join Al-Anon and then ACOA. My dad had actually sent me to an Al-Ateen meeting when I was a teenager, and the topic was not one I was ready to hear. So I had walked away for 13 years, and I regret that now, but I mean, I can't look back. It's done. I might have jump-started my healing a little quicker had I actually gone to those, but it's okay. I tell people there's never a too early or too late to start healing and taking back control of your life.
And there isn't one definitive path to transformation or to healing. It's whatever is going to work for that individual.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. There's no ABC. Even with my clients, people will be like, well, what does a path look like for you? And I'm like, it looks like whatever you need on a daily basis.
And empower yourself to pick those tools that are going to work for you. And I would imagine empowerment is a big message for you with your clients, because coming from addicted family systems, coming from chaotic households, disempowerment was probably the implicit or stated rule.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And conformity and just literally being whatever anybody needed you to be so you didn't rock the boat.
Yep.
I could wear many, many, many hats because I could be the caretaker. I could be the big brother or big sister. Or I could be the baby sister. I could be anything you needed me to be at the moment, whether it was a protector or a protected or whatever it was. I just conformed. I did what I had to do. And it was all out of survival.
And that can't be underestimated to our innate will to survive and our ability to survive very, very traumatic circumstances. I always tell individuals, don't underestimate your survival instinct. That's going to get you through a lot until you can begin to, again, embrace the tools of transformation. Survival will allow you to get there.
And give yourself grace. Mm-hmm. I say that. There was times when I was living with my mother, she didn't feed me. So every day I would run to the grocery store during my lunch break in high school, and I would steal anything I could. Anything. I would eat out of cookies. I would eat fruit, grapes, handfuls, stuff my pockets, and then run back to school. And I remember when I was going through like the 12-step program, and it's like, okay, make amends. And you know, that's a hard step of any 12-step program to make amends to the people you wronged. And I remember somebody joking with me and being like, well, you stole all that stuff for the grocery store. And I was like, and never once will I feel bad that I did that because I would have starved to death. I don't feel like I have to apologize for, you know, and there, so I tell people, give yourself some grace. You did what you had to do. And even like when you have children and you're those characteristics of being an adult child are making you do things that or say things or act ways that is not necessarily what you would consider the perfect parent, you don't know. And that's why I do what I do, because you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So, yeah, when you have children, when you're the child of an alcoholic and you have children, your one thinking until someone tells you differently is I'm going to do exactly the opposite of what my parents did to me. And that's not always healthy either.
One of the things I had individuals who requested services from me always tell me, said, I vowed I would never have the same relationship as my parents did. And they didn't, because they just reversed dysfunctional roles. If the father was more dominant, that son might have been in a relationship where he was more passive, or vice versa. You know, it's, and so, yeah, they didn't have the same relationship, but it was just a different form of dysfunction because that's all they knew. That's all they were exposed to.
And you know, life is a choice. And that's why I say awareness is 100% of the key. And I love the saying, and I say it all the time, and it's not my saying, but with awareness comes great responsibility. Because I was on the beginning of very, very beginning of my healing journey when my first child was born. He's what prompted me to start figuring out what was wrong. So he did take a lot of the brunt of that. He took a lot of my manicness and my depression and my, he did. But I can't go back. I'm not going to beat myself up. I'm going to say I was exactly where I needed to be at the time, and he got the best of me. So, you know, there's a lot of guilt and shame when you grow up the child of an alcoholic because you are an addicted person or any dysfunction because you do things that you wouldn't normally do. I mean, I had no boundaries. I didn't know about boundaries. So do I look back at my childhood and go, ooh, that was gross. Like, what was I thinking? Yes, but do I beat myself up? No, because I didn't know any better.
Yeah, boundaries in an addicted family system are non-existent, or at best, they're very blurred boundaries. They're not clear. And you can't beat yourself up for doing something you didn't know existed in the first place.
Exactly.
On your website, you mentioned that children of alcoholics and dysfunctional families feel unwanted, unheard, and unloved. What do you believe contributes to that? Is it the behavior of the dysfunctional adult itself, the unhealthy rules that develop as a result of attempting to survive the chaos that the dysfunctional adult's behavior causes, or is it a combination of things or other factors?
It's a combination, you know, and it works the same for any kind of dysfunction. And I give this example. I was talking to a client of mine the other day, and I was saying how my mother always told me I wasn't wanted. That was very acute, blatant trauma. Like, you're hated, you're not wanted. And it makes you feel unworthy. It makes you feel unloved. Your mind is saying that I must not be lovable then, because no mom would not want their child. Your brain thinks that is the one person that is there to protect you, and you will rely on them 100%. So I must be wrong because they can't possibly be. But then my client, she had this same feeling of unworthiness. And she said, but I grew up in a nice house. My parents weren't mean. Like, I don't get it. And we literally walked back her timeline. And in first or second grade, her mother didn't pick her up. I don't remember even why. She was late to pick her up. And her friend said to her, your mom is late a lot. She must not love you. That did the same damage to that little girl as my mother telling me she hated me every day of my life. So it's amazing how quickly our minds can decide and make up these stories that we're unlovable or unwanted. I mean, I knew I my mom told me every day. So it wasn't like a shock. It was just, but when, if I always was afraid to do something wrong because it was, oh, wow, if I'm not perfect, they're not going to love me or they're not going to want me. So like I said, I didn't understand unconditional love. I didn't understand that people would love me anyway if I wasn't perfect, or if I didn't perform the way I was supposed to, or if I didn't do what, you know, just anything.
Yeah, and perfection is something that I think comes from trying to anticipate the needs of somebody whose behavior is totally unpredictable. You know, if they come in, the alcoholic parent comes in, for example, and they're intoxicated and they're complaining that dinner wasn't on the table at a particular time, and then the family tries to anticipate the needs of that individual, and they have dinner on at the time that they think they're going to come in, and he comes in earlier and says, well, where's dinner? And it's like, so it's like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, and you just internalize the fact, well, you know, I wasn't perfect. I didn't get this right. And it's not about perfection. It's about doing your best, you know?
Right. Oh, absolutely. And perfectionism is a myth. You know, I tell people now, what you hold your standards to, because you were so used to having your standards held so high for yourself, if you would hold your own standards for someone the same to yourself as you hold them to someone else that you love, you wouldn't have that myth of perfectionism. You wouldn't find the need to be perfect. It was also, again, I mean, it depends on the situation. A lot of it is survival. I did everything perfect because I knew that I was going to be physically harmed if I didn't. You know, I knew that if I came home with straight A's, there might be some peace and quiet in the house for 6 hours. But if I didn't, all heck broke loose. I remember one year, I think it was seventh grade, I worked so hard to get straight A's, so hard. I remember it. And I remember showing it to my mother and my mom just going, I don't care. Show it to your father. And my father literally was like, it's about time you use that brain of yours. I was like, what? And I was like, tried so hard. And so a mature, smart, rational person would say, okay, obviously I can't hold myself to those standards, or I can't, you know, like those are standards are too high. So obviously I shouldn't do that. But no, someone that's been beaten down is going to just try harder and try, you know?
And at that age, you're still looking to please your parents. You're still looking to get some type of validation, and they just weren't capable of giving that kind of validation that you were looking for. But yet, it would be easy to take that personally as if, well, what did I do? It's something. It wasn't anything you did. It was basically your parents weren't capable of giving you that kind of validation that you needed at that particular point. It just wasn't in their, you know, makeup to do that.
Right. Yep. And we could literally, like, I just sit and I think of this and I'm like, we could literally go off on so many different mm-hmm. conversations and topics, and because it all does, it all stems from, and especially the people that I work with now, a genuine subconscious feeling of unworthiness.
Speaking of the people you work with, in your coaching practice, I'm sensing you're all about empowerment. Am I correct? So what do you do specifically to empower those whom you work with to transcend their own challenges?
First we figure out who they are, because most likely they don't even know who they are. They don't know what their core values are, what they believe in, what they like, what they don't like, what they want to tolerate. So we do a lot of just self-reflecting and trying to figure out who they are. Once they figure out like who they are, then we start to set some boundaries and start to teach them to stick up for themselves and be true to themselves and honor themselves, because they've probably never been validated, and nobody will until you respect yourself. You're not going to get that respect. So we start really just working on setting boundaries, sticking to them, and self-compassion, self-love, and self-care. Because it's even, I mean, you are an addiction counselor, so you've dealt with the families of everybody. You can't stop someone. You can't change other people. Mm-hmm. So the only thing you can do is react positively to what you're being dealt. And it's all a choice. So with every snarky comment someone says, you can either dig deep into your shell and put up a field, or you can say, no, that's not me. And you can fight back and advocate for yourself. So it's not a simple process. Well, let's put it this way. It's not an easy process, but it's a simple process, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. The steps are they're simply laid out. They're very clear. But after hearing years and years of you're not worthy, and internalizing those messages, it's got to be a challenge at times to get individuals to consistently, you know, align themselves with that philosophy. And I remember, Tammy, and I'm sure you probably have a similar story, you know, in working with other clients. I was working, this was when I first started in the addictions field. I was working with this wonderful individual who had very low self-esteem, who was a victim of abuse, a victim of, you know, physical abuse, sexual abuse. She came from an addicted family system, and that was just one of their issues. And we had been working a lot on self-esteem and validation. She'd been getting positive reinforcement from so many different people. And I remember one night, I was working the evening shift at this time. I was in the staff lounge making myself some dinner. And when she was in crisis, she had no boundaries as far as she just had to get whatever it was off of her chest. But I respected that with her because it wasn't malicious. It was just that she needed to get it off her chest when she needed to. She bursts into the staff lounge, sits down, starts crying, and says, "Dave, I'm feeling good. What's wrong with me?" And that, to me, summed up how difficult it is for an individual coming from a chaotic situation to align with the fact that somebody actually thinks they have some self-worth, and they're not attaching any conditions on that. They're not asking you for anything. And that just struck me when I, you know, first got into the field in terms of how difficult it was for her to align with that.
Oh, yeah. And even, you know, even when you start to get those feelings of validation, you're going to knock yourself down 100 times with just guilt. You got that inner critic that's just coming back at you. And even though you go, "Oh, wow, he truly, genuinely likes me," the first thing you're going to think in your mind is, "But he won't if I do this, or he won't if I do that." So I tell people, until you stop with the buts, you know, and stop with the "he does but" or "I do but," you're not there. You know, there's still more work and more. It's like, I don't know with your clients if you did a lot of inner child work. That was so instrumental in my healing, because everything that I thought was fed to me when I was a very small child. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get past that, because you can say to yourself, "I am worthy, I am good, I am lovable, I am all of this stuff." But until you truly believe it deep, deep down, when the rubber hits the road and you got to make a split decision and you got to react, you're going to be reacting from that hurt person. You're going to be, you know, sometimes I'll still do it to myself. Somebody will say something and I will literally give back some little snarky comment. And then I'm like, "Tammy, that wasn't you. That was that 5-year-old you. It was that you that didn't, you know, somebody poked the bear again." And so that was instrumental in me getting back my self-worth and feeling worthy. I had to go back and literally sit with that 5 or 6-year-old me and give it everything and all the love that it didn't get when it was 5 or 6. So it could feel confident enough to come into the real world.
Yeah, and I don't discount at all the importance of inner child work. In my practice, I worked primarily in a short-term rehab. So I was really hesitant to really open up that kind of dialogue, given the fact that I was working with individuals for a short period of time. But what I would do is try to align them with a therapist whose specialty was inner child work. And also would suggest to them as part of their aftercare that they may want to consider doing inner child work with somebody that they trust.
And it's great because we're in a new world now. Like, you can literally teach yourself through podcasting and the joy of podcasting, because you can teach yourself. You can listen to it and there's all these tips and strategies. And that's kind of how I look at coaching. I'm literally nothing more than a toolbox, and I'm there to help you access those tools.
Exactly. Speaking of tools, tell us about your book, Helping Children of Alcoholics and Other At-Risk Students. And what tools do you share that can help these children transcend the chaos of dealing with an adult alcoholic or dysfunctional adult?
So there's actually 2 books that kind of coincide together. And the one is Surviving Alcoholic Parents, which is a teen's guide. The Helping Students, or Helping Children of Alcoholics and Other At-Risk Students, That was very specifically written for educators. Okay. Because I think that there is so much denial and shame and guilt still attached to people that are suffering and people that are, you know, homeless families and all of this stuff, that I wanted a way for parents or for teachers and educators to be able to look at these children and go, okay, something is going on. So even if I can't get them to come out to me and say, hey, I'm struggling, this is happening, that's happening, you should be able to empower them as children to start to deal with some of these things. I kind of say healing the damage before the damage is done, if that makes sense. So it's really starting to empower them to just feel self-love, to build, you know, have compassion for themselves and for others, and for getting children to build, like, it's almost like they can build their own little community of trust and empowerment, even at young ages, without having to be like, okay, your mom clearly has a problem, let's talk, you know? So it was just my way of having, because a lot of teachers don't know. And a lot of teachers, even when they think there's a problem, they don't know how to address it. You know, I joke and I say, if even one of my 51 teachers had ever said to me, Tammy, why do you sleep on the desk all day long? I might have said, because it's the only place I can sleep with both eyes shut. But nobody ever asked me. So I just kept getting in trouble. I kept getting labeled the lazy kid, the kid that doesn't want to learn, the kid that doesn't care. And, you know, and then I became a teacher. So as a teacher, if you don't know anything else from, you know, like from looking at a classroom of students, it's that if you are just trying to survive as a child, you don't care about math, reading, writing, arithmetic. You don't care about that stuff. All you're trying to do is get to the next day.
Yeah. Get to the next moment, depending on how that day's going.
Yep.
Tammy, as we're getting to the wrap-up portion of the show, I've got two more questions for you. First, is give our listeners one or two takeaways from your life experiences that can help them effectively navigate life challenges.
Okay, the first thing I would say is know deep in your heart that you are worth it. And if you don't truly feel, this is a test you can give yourself. Say to yourself, I love ice cream. Love ice cream. And see how you feel. If you get this warm, fuzzy feeling, then you probably love ice cream. Say to yourself now, I deserve all good things. Look in the mirror and say it. If you get a pit in your stomach, then you still have some layers to peel back. And you are worth it 100%. Until you can say, I deserve all good things without a pit in your stomach, you're worth exploring more. And there's always something to explore when it comes to healing. And the other thing I would say is, especially people that are coming out of it, no matter what happens, one, you always have a choice into how you react to it. And the other thing is that it's just a moment in time. So if you can just get through that moment of time, there is better stuff and better choices and better things on the outside. So I used to do that. I would just had to get through one more minute, like you said, or one more hour or one more day, whatever it is. But whatever is happening, no matter how bad it is, it's a moment in time. And there's people out there that can show you how to reframe those moments later and to work with those moments. But for the time being, just know that it's going to pass.
And just focus on getting through that moment.
Yep.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of my favorite musicians and authors, Neil Peart, who wrote about his own journey of loss in his book, Ghostwriter Travels on the Healing Road. He said, keep moving. Something will come up. Keep moving. Something will come up. And that teaching still resonates with me. And particularly when I hear coaches and other therapists say, focus on getting through that moment. Trust your survival instincts. So my last question for you is, how can individuals get in touch with you? How can they contract for your coaching services? What is the best way for them to do that, Tammy?
Probably the best way is just to go to my website. It's just my name. Everything is kind of housed there. It's just www.tammyvincent.com. You can reach out. You can book a coffee chat. You can talk to me about being on my podcast, whatever it is. I love to talk to people, and that's really the best way. It has different, multiple ways of connecting with me. I do have a Facebook group called Children of Alcoholics or Children of Dysfunctional Families Thriving Now. And that's a great place to get all kinds of resources. But you can reach out to me on Facebook, But the best and easiest is probably just through my website.
And what is the name of your podcast?
It's called Adult Child of Dysfunction.
Yes. The sign of right in the back of you on the wall, Adult Child of Dysfunction. Got it.
Oh, yeah. That's my podcast little label thing. Where is it?
Well, yeah. When this drops on YouTube, they'll be able to see that quite prominently. So, Tammy, with that, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. I truly enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you for having me, Dave. I'm excited to be here and excited to share messages of hope, because it's never, anybody can get through anything.
That's right. And I'm all about sharing hope. So, and I think any message of hope that we can give to our viewers and our listeners, particularly in these troubled times, I think is needed and is welcome. So with that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.